Good morning. Today is 23 July 2014. I am Major Randolph Scott Harrison, and I'm conducting a telephonic interview with retired Colonel John Chitwood. He was the 5th Program Director of the Interservice Physician Assistant Program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Scott?
All right, sir. Sir, what I'd like to start off with this morning is a background question. I'd like to talk, if you would talk to us briefly, about your formative years.
Okay. Well, I'm from St. Augustine, Florida, and actually kind of rare for a Floridian, and that is I'm a fourth generation Floridian, and my daughters are fifth generation Floridians, and I'm very proud of that heritage. My grandfather was a pharmacist. My mother was a pharmacist, and my father still is a pharmacist. So I grew up in the medical care field, so to speak, by working at our drugstores, our pharmacies. I was going to school. Actually, I was working two jobs and going to school and received my associate's degree with my ultimate goal of going to pharmacy school. I wanted some more money, so I joined the Florida Army National Guard because if you became a medic, they would give you more scholarship money than if you became an infantryman or something. And it was then, working as a medic in the Florida Guard, that I became affiliated or associated with PAs, the PA profession, and began thinking, you know, that'd be a much better fit for me and my personality than filling prescriptions. At that time, I met Colonel, and now he's Colonel retired, Jim McNamara, who was actually the first PA I ever met. And to working with him, it's like, gee, this is what I want to do. So, but I go to pick up my first scholarship check to continue school, and the training manager at the unit said, well, I've reviewed your transcripts, and you have all the prerequisites for PA school. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, we would pay you to go to school. I said, well, I'm your man then, so let's start the application process. So, and, of course, that application process, as you know, could take a year or so. But, you know, really just 2 years after I joined the Guard, I was reporting to first here to Fort Sam Houston and then to Shepherd Air Force Base for PA school, because at that time the Guard and Reserve PAs were going to the Air Force program and not the Army program.
Yes, sir. So you were at, so you went to the Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls. That's correct?
That's correct. It was accredited by Oklahoma University at the time.
Oklahoma. Now, they've gone through a couple different schools. Is that correct, sir? They was St. Francis at one time?
No, it was Oklahoma and Nebraska. St. Francis never underwrote the PA program, but they were the first to offer a distance learning master's degree for PAs. And so they held actually some of the first classes on weekends and nights in our facilities there so the PAs could earn a master's degree. And the reason they were doing that is because, you know, that law was passed in the early 90s that said that PAs could get a professional bonus. And we fought that for several years. But one of the ways when we were fighting it was, you know, the powers that would be at the Pentagon would come back and say, well, you don't have a graduate degree for your specialty. And so Bill Duryea, who was a PA and also a PhD, who's retired from St. Francis, he stepped forward and designed a program so that PAs could be ready to get the professional bonus when it became available. Some of that first, you'll recognize some of the names from that first class, retired Admiral Mike Milner, retired Lieutenant Colonel Kathy Adamson, retired Lieutenant Colonel Ron Adamson, believe Commander, or maybe Captain now, Dave Holder was in that class. I was trying to remember everybody was in there. I was not in that class, but I was one of their professors.
Okay. So so if I follow that timeline correctly, sir, you're saying that when you were at Shepherd, Oklahoma was the university that was assigned with Shepherd, and then or the Air Force PA program, and then Nebraska took over later on. But St. Francis offered a distance learning master's to be able to take it to that next step.
Yes, and people from East Francis' service, I can't recall the Army participants at this time, but, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Public Health Service. I don't remember if a Coast Guard was in there or not.
Okay, all right. Well, great. That's very helpful. That really clears up a lot of understanding to that timeline. Do you have any recollection of when they went from the Oklahoma to the Nebraska Association?
Sure. I believe it was in the 89 to 90 time frame. I graduated from PA school in 86. In the class after me was the last class. In Infinite Wisdom, they had good retention rates, which you do have good retention rates for PAs for at least 10 years until they don't have a commitment anymore, and then you have a lot of get out. But they decided to close the Air Force PA program, so they did that in 87. But by mid-80s or early 89, they had a crisis on their hands. Excuse me, retention crisis, and so they decided to reopen the program, and then they did. They went through the normal bidding process, and Nebraska won that bid. Now, Nebraska is very PA-friendly, and that falls back to one person's work over 30 or 40 years, and that's Major Retired Jesse Edwards. Jesse was high up in the infrastructure at University of Nebraska Medical Center, and a retired Air Force Medical Service Corps officer. And so Jesse really pushed getting Nebraska affiliated with the Air Force, and then eventually with IPAP. So.
Wow. Okay, that's awesome. I wasn't aware of that. Okay. All right. So moving on to a little bit more about the IPAP now, sir. My first question to you would be, what would you consider to be unique about the IPAP that makes it different from the other PA programs? Obviously, now you've been associated with other programs, starting with the Air Force's program, and then being the fifth program director at the IPAP, and then after active duty retirement roles.
Yes, but what's unique, first of all, let's talk just a little bit about ITRO. A lot of people think ITRO, it came out of Congress, the Interagency Training Reorganization Act, came out in the early 90s. That's not really true. It came out in the late 70s, but essentially the Department of Defense ignored the directive, and then Congress took the chance to reassert it back in 92, I believe. And that's how the talks came about what programs could we bring together that are similar enough that all the services can train together. And IPAP was an obvious choice to look at, and they did. And from the very beginning, what you would see as the obstacle is the inter-service differences and some sibling rivalry. But in the end, at the end of the day, and to this day still, that actually is the reason that IPAP has survived and thrived and exists. Because at two or three different times during the past 18 years, whether the Army decreases the number they want to train, or the Air Force does, or the Air Force needs to increase, or the Guard and Reserve needs to increase, somebody else needs to decline, it's never given an individual service the cause to pause to say, do we need to keep this training platform open, or do we just need to recruit more from the outside, or do we need some people in civilian schools? So the initial differences actually are the greatest strength to the program, and that is the service differences.
Okay. Let me just step back for one second, because this is the first time I've heard about this. You made a comment about in the 1970s an ABC training.
ITRO training, ITRO.
Yes, sir.
And actually, there's a reference to it Colonel Adamson, or either Colonel Adamson, can get you onto that website for the Society of Air Force PA's newsletter. And if they look back through the archives of those newsletters, there's a newsletter at sometimes in 77 to 79 time frame that talks about ITRO, how ITRO is coming. But then it just kind of disappeared for 15 or so years.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. That's the first time I heard about that, at least from the 1970 version in that respect. All right. Well, thank you. Sir, can you tell me a little bit more about your involvement in the IPAP? Obviously, you're the fifth program director.
My involvement began in the discussion phase. Two or three times, I was not one of the committee members, but two or three times when they met here in San Antonio, I was invited down from Shepherd Air Force Base, which is in Wichita Falls. So that was always a great treat to get out of there for a few days for a meeting to give my input on some matters. And so I did that. That was prior to 96. And then I went away from education for a few years when I went to work at the White House for 3 years. And then I was lucky enough to, similar to your education with industry, I received a AFET scholarship to get a degree in education specifically to prepare me to go back to IPAP, which I did, and taught there for three more years and was the Air Force's operations officer. And then true to form, the Air Force then decided to send me to overseas, since I just bought a new house, and and sent me to Turkey. But the same turn of luck in Turkey, I went there to be a squadron commander, but I ended up being the hospital commander. And of course, that's a unique hospital, and it was in a combat zone at the time. So that was, the challenges were fun for me. I was thrown into the deep end of the ocean and was able to tread water. Then they decided I need to go back to D.C., and then another education program, and then back to D.C. And by then I had learned, well, by then I was on the colonel's list, and they'd come and ask me, hey, do you want to go to San Antonio? And I said yes, and then they said, well, we're not going to send you. And a couple months later they came back and asked me, hey, do you want to go to San Antonio? I said, there's two places I don't want to go, and that's San Antonio and Europe. And they said, well, okay, we're sending you to San Antonio then. So I came back down here as the actually a chief medical consultant for the Air Force, besides the PA consultant to the Surgeon General. And within 2 years of that job, the IPAP job became available, and that's when I was appointed to it. So I guess that was 2009-2010
time frame. Okay. What barriers did you have to overcome when you were the program director? Obviously, it looks like you had a couple times there. You were associated in the beginning, and then coming back and teaching, and then coming back again, and then moving into the program director. So obviously, you had a chance to see it at different phases. What kind of barriers do you think that you had to overcome during this time?
The barriers are actually the same for IPAP as they are for any large, multifaceted organization, and that is communication and leadership and a lot of what I call MBWA, management by walking around. You know, let people see you, meet with them, find out what their concerns are, and then go forward from there. It helps that most that the PAs who end up being the program director are long-term PAs. Some people call us dinosaurs, which is not appreciative since they're extinct and we're not. But they have an extensive Rolodex, and now with smartphones, you know, if I had a concern with the Navy, of course, the first person I'll talk to would be the Navy senior IPAP rep. And then the next step would be his core director, the person, their person that works for their Surgeon General that's a PA. And so just being able to talk through things and keep things moving forward, like I say, it's pretty standard management. But, you know, you have to know all the intricacies of the inner service and the Department of Defense relationships as well as RPA, NCCPA, and AAPA. So it all comes down to communication and decreasing obfuscation and finding out what everybody needs and wants and seeing how the organization can partially fulfill that. You never can fully fulfill somebody's needs.
Okay, sir. So working in a joint environment like that, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, what would you say some of the key players are and the pros and cons of those things?
You know, the key players, as I mentioned, the senior service reps for each service, as with any PA program, the medical director and the program director, but then it branches out, spokes out to the senior service PAs and to the surgeon generals and having that deep Rolodex. But also, too, at the same time, the program director has to have a close working relationship within the graduate school, because there's several schools in the graduate school, and the PA program is one of them, by far the largest. But being able to work with those other program directors, and, you know, if the physical therapists need a lecture on pharmacology, that we'll supply the pharmacology instructor, and if the dietitians can give us a lecture on nutrition, you know, we swap back and forth that way. And then, of course, the top of that pyramid is the dean of the graduate school, and being able to meet and speak and work out issues directly with the dean of the graduate school is a must-have strength. Okay. So, go ahead.
No, I was concurring. I can see where that would be very beneficial.
So, the joint service environment, we look at it as being unique, but it's less unique than it was 30 years ago when I came in, and 32 years ago when I enlisted, and it's going to be less unique in the future. You know, when I worked at in D.C., I was in a joint service environment in one school, and then even when I went to Air War College, you know, we had not only students from each service, but also foreign military in there. So, you know, by the time you get to be a lieutenant colonel or colonel, you've already been exposed to it before and have no problem with it.
Okay. Sir, as a program director, were you able to accomplish everything you had set out to do?
Of course not, but I had to come to the realization back in the early 90s that I'm never going to accomplish all my goals, but I like the Army saying that at the end of the day, can I say that I'm closer to my objective than I was yesterday? And so with that, I can say I'm happy with what we were able to accomplish. And, you know, obviously Bill Tozier got the expansion of the program rolling. And then we got to the pleasure of implementing it and the challenge of implementing it. And so, yes, but by the, every day and then by the end of my tenure there, I was happy. I was happy with what I achieved. I wouldn't call it settling, but I was happy with what I achieved.
Sir, what lessons learned, you know, looking back over it, what would you say are the lessons learned while dealing with the IPAP?
That it's a very complex and fluid environment. The inner service aspect of it is the strongest point. Having all services on faculty, having all services represented in the student body. So I would say that's the biggest lesson learned. And another lesson learned was as I went to national meetings, even though I've gone to different national meetings and forums quite a bit over the past 20-something years, the number of PA educators who had no idea that IPAP exists and is the largest PA program there is, that I think that the program director and all military PAs need to bang that drum a little bit more.
Okay. All right. So, sir, looking at a couple of the, touching back on some of the unique characteristics of the program, I've talked, obviously, with a few different people at this point, Captain Brackage, Casey Bond, which was one of the early people working in there, Colonel Tozier. And we've talked a little bit about some of the unique characteristics of the PA program. And in those unique characteristics, some of the things we talked a little bit about were the, you know, the entrance criteria, how it's less than the other programs.
Yes.
And, you know, like, what, so taking in that context, sir, if you were at a national conference, what would be some of the things that you would tout as a program director of what this program does that other programs don't?
Well, since we have a unique and finite population that we draw from, we get the best from that finite pool of applicants. I would say one way that strengthens us is we don't have, our student body isn't completely, it's a large student body, but it's not completely comprised of people who started out in the medical track and went forward from there. You know, we've had linguists, we've had paralegals, we've had mechanics, wrench turners, infantry, obviously, armor, airborne, aviation, we've had it all. And I think that really leads to a strong admixture, as it were, for PAs to draw from. And it's kind of similar to what we're seeing, interestingly enough, it's similar to what we're seeing with some medical schools. I was talking to an applicant to Duke Medical School at lunch the other day, and they search out that they want fully 50% of their entering class to be non-biological sciences majors, so that they get that same type of flora, as it were, to draw from. So now the entrance standards, there is a minimum. Some branches choose to add more to the minimum. Some keep it at the minimum. And you do have to be wary that occasionally some branches will try to slip through somebody below the minimum. So, and that's usually not due to a PA's oversight, but usually due to a medical administrator education type at a higher headquarters looking and saying, well, this looks like a good applicant or a great applicant, but they don't have the academics behind them. Well, they may be a great applicant, but if you don't have, as you know, if you don't have that academic foundation, and then having that academic foundation be willing to work really, really hard, then you could be lost from day one.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. So the looking at some of the characteristics, like, for example, the graduation rate. So, you know, like right now, there's the cycle runs, there's a maximum of 80 students that can be in each of the classes. So you potentially could have 240 graduates, and that's without anybody rolling over from a previous class into there. So obviously that in and of itself is a unique and larger characteristic compared to any of the others.
Yes.
But one of the other things that I found interesting is looking at the performance standards. And if you look at the performance standards and the PANT scores and where they are falling across the board against the national average. I mean, like, I believe right now in 2013, they're somewhere around 98%. And the national average is in the low 90s, right? 93 or 91, somewhere around there. So, when you see scores like that, when you're talking about a population that could not have been accepted to a traditional PA program that's out there, and you see them accomplishing something like that, what do you think about that?
Well, what I think about that is we teach a lot of classroom hours. And I'm sorry, I don't know the current number of classroom hours, but it's a lot. I mean, they may get an afternoon off once or twice a week, but you know, as you know, they need it to study and then also to get the military's physical fitness standards to adhere to. So I think it speaks directly to our standards and our professors, the depth of material that they teach to the students, and then also the standard we have of, you know, what makes you eligible for relief and for recycle. And we go by those standards very stringently. You know, if you have an exceptional life event, but we're doing well before that exceptional life event, well then, maybe it's cost effective and good for you and good for the military to recycle. But whereas if you're failing miserably, we're not going to keep taking, well, because we don't take your tuition money, but we're not going to, hold you on for another year and let you come back and rejoin the class next year. You know, that's just not going to happen because we have to be stewards of the American people's money. So I think because of that, because of the professors and because the students know that, and because the students are from a military background, so, you know, military and former military, we tend to show up to work on time and do what needs to be done to accomplish the mission, and don't just decide one day we're not going to work, we're going fishing instead, although I think that's the best part of retirement. So I think it's that. I think it's a combination of who we're able to draw from, and then since it's brutal. As you know, the student schedule is brutal. And then also, too, besides the didactic phase, when we send them to phase two, we're sending them to a hospital. You know, I feel sorry for the programs that have to go out into the community. And, you know, they may send a student from Oregon to Minnesota for a family practice course and then to Florida for orthopedics, and they'd be working in somebody's clinic. But I think the hospital work, you know, being able to round on the patients and see them in the clinic, round on them in the hospital, and participate in surgery, I think that gives our students, our graduates, a leg up in that, you know, they've been working with residents. They're learning a lot of the same things the residents are learning, besides the classroom part that we try to impart on them before they leave Fort Sam Houston. And so I think all that gallimaufry, as it were, comes together as a beautiful stew, and that's our success.
Okay. Well, that's very much appreciated, sir. I appreciate the information on that. Last comment, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to comment on in regards to the things that we discussed today or anything else?
Just that, you know, Duke obviously led the way, and they led the way with former Navy corpsmen with PAs, and we've been doing PA education in some form or fashion since, I believe, 72 in the militaries. But really, you know, we've got to give a nod to those early founders of the profession and the first PAs in the military who were keeping their enlisted rank or warrant officer rank, or getting warrant officer rank and going through those turmoils and then eventually commissioning of the different branches of the service. And then also the people who retired from the military but didn't disassociate themselves with the military. You know, when you have great people like Bill Marquardt and Tom Limley and David Gwynn and Jesse Edwards. Even though Jesse was not a PA, he was at the AAPA annual meeting every year, and Society Air Force PAs, and probably the Society of Army and Navy PA meetings. All these people, you know, we stood and we stand on the foundation and on their shoulders for what they built. And that coupled with a strong academy and strong commission and strong RPA standards are what make the profession what it is today and what makes ITAP what it is today. So it would be very remiss not to thank all those folks that have come before us and a lot of them still in the picture who have done the heavy lifting so that the profession can move forward.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your service and everything you've done for us, sir.